For people living in war zones, there is death and destruction. And there is the ongoing effort to make it through daily life amidst the debris during an occupation. Access to basics, food, water, electricity, are not always easy. In Ukraine, like other war zones in history, some residents have worked with the occupiers to help get through each day. Reporter Joshua Yaffe documents the story of the collaborators, as some call them, in a piece in The New Yorker, and he joins us now from Kyiv. Joshua, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've done extensive reporting in eastern Ukraine, Izyum. This is an area the Russians invaded, occupied for many months, and then Ukraine came back and recaptured the city. During the time of Russian occupation, you found several people who had been working with the Russians. Is there one person whose story really stays with you?
Well, the person is a young man named Pavel Golub. When the occupation came, he found himself hungry, like many people in Izyum. There was difficult to get supplies, food, medicine. The Russian army, which was in charge of Izyum by April, fully occupied the city, sporadically handed out humanitarian aid, but it was not enough, hard to feed a family. Pavel had a wife, children, parents, extended family. And he was tempted by an offer that came from the occupation authority in Izyum that those who were willing to clear rubble and collect bodies of those who were killed would be eligible for additional food aid. And at the same time, as Pavel thought, he would be doing something, however distasteful and difficult, but necessary for his hometown, given that bodies were laying in the street. People were buried by the side of the road. As Pavel told me, there were burial mounds near the kindergarten where his son went to school, and something had to be done. And at the same time, he could maybe get a little bit more food for himself and his family.
Was Pavel conflicted about this?
He certainly didn't like, as no one would, the actual immediate physicality of the work. Was deeply unpleasant and traumatizing. Among the first bodies he collected was that of a woman named Yelena, who Pavel actually had gone to school with, who was killed when her building had been bombed, along with her entire family, husband, children, parents, just wiped out the whole family, along with dozens of people who lived in this apartment building. So this work was not just physically and emotionally demanding, but traumatizing, just given the small scale of Izyum and the intimacy of the city. He also didn't like that he was doing this at the behest, or at least with the approval of the Russian occupying forces. They were the ones who, for example, gave the passes that allowed Pavel and others in this volunteer brigade to move around the city and engage in the burials.
What were some of the other everyday needs for Izyum that local residents pitched in to help meet?
Well, here we get into murky territory, just like, in fact, we do with the burials. And Pavel later came under suspicion for a collaboration with Russian forces, given his involvement in those burials. But everything from keeping the water running to teaching in the schools required locals to come back to work and agree to work under the Russian occupying authorities. And that required a sliding scale, you might say, of moral compromise. For example, the head of the water department agreed to return to work under the occupying forces and fix the pipes and kept the water going. That's one level of collaboration. Another are the school principals and school teachers in town who agreed to come back and teach the Russian program. And the Russian program, of course, is predicated on a negation of Ukrainian history, of Ukrainian statehood, Ukrainian language. So you very quickly run into serious ideological and political issues. So school principals, teachers are treated differently now that Izyum has been liberated and Ukrainian authorities are back in town. Those authorities, law enforcement, police, prosecutors are trying to sort through who did what under occupation and where should the bar of responsibility be placed. But those are really hard questions. What's forgivable and understandable? What actually crosses the line into some sort of treachery that can't and shouldn't be forgiven?
When you think about the different reasons a person would work for an occupying government, how do you think about those reasons as you discovered them in the course of your reporting?
I think it's really a spectrum. In a place like Izyum, you had people who were pro-Russian, who welcomed the Russian invading force and worked for it willingly. You had others who saw a chance to take on a position they might not have had access to before the war. In wartime and occupation, the idea of having access to food, medicine, other goods that might be in short supply looks very tempting. Others saw it as a matter of basic survival. Either they were threatened with physical violence, which was a very credible threat. Ukrainian authority had vanished as the city was taken over by the Russian military. And I think ultimately, people chose to cooperate or collaborate with Russian forces, not for one of those reasons, but for a cocktail of those reasons.
You're painting this picture that seems to have a lot of grays. That is, you know, people in the fog of a war, some of them make the decisions they do to get food for their families, or perhaps as they see it, to provide services. Often we think of collaborators as kind of black and white traitors. You're painting a much more, a very different kind of gray story here. In the end, Pavel, what happened to him?
Well, after Izum was liberated, he was held in a facility for other potential or suspected collaborators, interrogated. He was ultimately released after 42 days, and he ultimately left Ukraine to another country in Europe that he didn't want me to name, where he's found a job and trying to start a new life for himself. But he certainly feels aggrieved by this whole situation. He feels like he tried to do something difficult but necessary for the city and ended up being suspected as being a collaborator because of it. Occupation, by definition, is a really fraught, complex, murky set of circumstances. I tend to think, after my time reporting in Izum, that act of survival under occupation is such that it's hard to retain pure good qualities, and even those who may do bad may have started out with good motives. It just becomes very difficult to untangle.
Yeah. You know, Joshua, this is a story that touches very close to my own family. My grandfather in China was a convicted collaborator in the fog of World War II. He chose to work for the Japanese occupiers in the city of Wuhan. Now a lot of us know the city of Wuhan. As best we know, he was doing food distribution and other things. Years later, he was arrested and, you know, taken to a labor camp. Didn't come back. And my question for you is, for all the complex, potentially understandable reasons people might choose to work for an occupying force right now in Ukraine, are the Ukrainians punishing collaborators, assumed collaborators, in kind of a black and white way?
Such an interesting and fascinating and resonant story you told about your own family history. It really indeed calls to mind so much of what I learned and saw in Izum, where it's very difficult, certainly for the state, for law enforcement to draw the line, even more difficult for people, individual neighbors, to understand how to live side by side. But to Ukraine's credit, I don't think it's actually avoiding the complicated distinctions of collaboration or essentially painting everyone with the same brush. Teachers, for example, are removed from schools, but they tend not to be held criminally liable. Those who are criminally charged tend to be people either who occupied high up positions in the occupation administration, for example, the Russian-installed mayor of Izum. But interestingly, that person, along with the other top brass, let's say, of Izum's occupation, fled to Russia along with Russian forces when the city was liberated. So really, the top level of collaborators aren't there. What the Ukrainian state is left with is this middle kind of rung of collaborators, where things quickly get much more complicated. If someone, say, gave actual or actionable intelligence to Russian forces about where Ukrainian troop positions were, where Ukrainian arms supplies were, those people are being held criminally liable.
And finally, Joshua, what about Izum now? Surely this issue of collaboration can pit neighbor against neighbor. There can be anger that simmers between members of the same community. Do you sense that there is now a tension in the city?
One of the stories I wrote about from our article for The New Yorker was exactly that, of two neighbors on one street. One neighbor during the occupation was arrested, interrogated, and tortured over a series of many days, quite brutally, by Russian forces. And he has every reason to suspect that the reason he was detained was that he was denounced by another neighbor on that same street. But now that Azum is liberated, these two neighbors are back living literally across the street from one another.
Oh my goodness.
To say that relations are strained is an understatement. And I don't know if, when, or how those relationships ever heal.
Yeah. Joshua Yaffa is a contributing writer for The New Yorker, and his latest piece is The Collaborators. Joshua, thanks for the time, and travel safe in Ukraine.
Thank you.